Colonel Dave Duray and Brigadier General Starl Austin come forward. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Colonel Dave Duray, Oregon Military Department Director of Installations, and I'm accompanied by Brigadier General Starl Austin, who's here to testify on Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 8.
Please go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Starl Austin, Brigadier General, USAF, retired. I worked 23 years at the military department, and 10 of them as General Anderson's deputy, and that's the primary reason that I'm here today. Colonel Caldwell was not able to be here. I'm here, of course, in support of the bill. I was a part of the dedication ceremony at the new building, and if you haven't seen it, you should go look. It's a great place. General Anderson was the man who was primarily responsible for Oregon having a emergency command center in the beginning. Back in 1962, during the Columbus Day floods, all the state agencies, not just the military department, we fell flat on our face pretty much. Everybody did their job, but the primary reason was that we couldn't talk to one another. We didn't know. The car didn't know what the state police were doing. The state police didn't know what the highway department was doing. So there was no basic communication at all. I even spent the midnight in Governor Hatfield's kitchen with a guy in a Jeep running around picking up information and bringing it into us. Anyway, as a result of that, not very long after that, we started to put together the Governor's Emergency Command Post, which initially was in the basement of the Capitol in Room 50. Put in telephones, we got all the various agencies that were involved, that needed to be involved, were involved. We had radios from all those agencies installed in the Civil Defense Radio Room, which was then down in that area as well. And by the time the 1964 floods came around, we had a growing operation. We had one command post exercises. We knew each other. We could communicate all across the state with all of the agencies. And we were able, without any problem, to handle the emergency of the 1964 Christmas floods. The crowning thing for me, General Anderson was chief of staff in the command post. He put it together for Governor Hatfield and Governor Hatfield's staff. And I was General Anderson's deputy. And the crowning thing for me in that whole exercise, other than being able to do the job like we did, and not just the military department, but all the state agencies, was a phone telephone call that I had from the Philadelphia Inquirer when I was on duty on Christmas Eve. In the center. We don't know how come we haven't asked for federal help. We said, California has, why haven't you? And I told them, very frankly, we were prepared for this kind of emergency, and as of that time, we did not need federal help. If we needed it, we'd ask for it, but we never did. We never did need it. We were able to cope with it ourselves. And it's from that beginning that the whole concept of a central command center for the state has developed. It fell by the wayside a little while, and it's come back now. This new building, which is named for General Anderson, is really the Cadillac of state emergency command centers in the whole United States. Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Air Force, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Manpower and Reserve Affairs, was one of the speakers at the dedication ceremony, and she said that we were leaps and bounds ahead of any other state in putting together a coordinated facility that was prepared to respond under the new Department of Homeland Security. I'll get it in a minute. I should have notes, I guess. Anyway, in fact, this building was on her wall. The picture was on her wall, and she used it as an example for others who came in and were talking about doing something like this. The interesting part is that we had it designed and built and ready to go before there was a Department of Homeland Security, because we had recognized in the past, and General Anderson was primarily responsible for that in my mind. He also was responsible for the first Adjutant General to set up a combined staff, which included both the Army National Guard and the Air National Guard, into a single staff, which is now by directive from the Department of Defense, where everybody's going to operate, and him because of the Homeland Security situation. So I think it's very appropriate that this building, more than any other, be named in honor of General Anderson, and this resolution, which supports that, would be very much appreciated. And I know Mrs. Anderson would appreciate it very much, and I would personally. Okay. If there are questions, I'd be glad to answer.
Okay. Thank you. Colonel Austin, did you have anything to add?
No.
Okay. Any questions?
All right. Mr. Chair.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. This isn't really a question. I've lived in Oregon but for 3 years of my life. This is the first time I've heard of this agency, this emergency response United Headquarters approach. It's not because I haven't been paying attention, except obviously not to this, but I continue to marvel as I've served in the legislature now for my second term of how many things and how many wonderful people are in Oregon who I knew nothing about, who were busy taking care of me and other people in Oregon. And I thank you for your testimony today and for letting us know about General Anderson.
Thank you very much.
And Colonel, I'm sorry for calling you Colonel Austin, Colonel Perry. Just mixed up the names there. But General, I appreciate you coming in and sharing this information with us.
Well, thank you. General Anderson was a good, he was my boss for 10 years and was also a very good friend.
Yeah, that's great. And we appreciate your help and your testimony. See nothing further. Thank you. And no one else signed up to testify on this bill, so we will close the public hearing on SCR 8 and open up a work session on Senate Concurrent Resolution 8. Representative Flores?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Concurrent Resolution 8 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores moves Senate Concurrent Resolution 8 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? We'll call the roll, please.
Aye.
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 And Chair votes aye, and we'll have Representative Forrest carry this bill on the floor. And that closes the work session on SCR 8, and now open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 666. And colleagues, on 666, we have the bill as it came over to us from the Senate, and this was something that was sponsored by Representative Dukes, or Senator Dukes, and Representative Hobson had some knowledge on it too. We understand they're both tied up in some committee or caucuses, so there's also, in addition to the bill that came over from the Senate, there is the Dash A2 amendments, and ask Representative Backlund to go to the podium, please, and explain this amendment. Senator Dukes, if you want to come forward, we were just starting to talk about your bill. Senator, if you would like to open with an explanation of your bill.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Joan Duke, State Senator from District 16, and I am here because of the kindness of State Senator Charles Starr, who lent us his bill, to tell you a story that occurred in my district earlier this year. I have a group that regularly transports older veterans to the veterans from Clatsop County to the Veterans Hospital in Portland. And they transport across Highway 26, which goes up into a, for us, mountainous area, at higher elevation, and often has some of the late snow and ice in the season. So that organization requested from ODOT that they be allowed to continue using their studded tires past the deadline for removal of those tires. And there's nothing in state law that allows ODOT to make that kind of exemption. So they had to take them off. Now, there's no way to know whether that resulted in the accident that happened or didn't result in the accident that happened, but they were transporting. They were on Highway 26. They hit snow and ice. They rolled the van. It went off the road. The worst injured was the 84-year-old veteran who broke a lot of bones. No one died, fortunately, but this bill would allow regular, since I left my glasses in the other hearing room, regularly scheduled medical transport service to have an out-and-out exemption on the use of studded tires, which ODOT tells me is the way to handle it. They will do it through administrative rule, which they assure me will be painless, and it will allow them to use their discretion. They're not interested in using studded tires unless they believe they need them. But these are folks that were already in bad shape. They really didn't need to be, you know, don't need to be dumped over the edge, literally speaking. So I hope that you will help us. Yes, you will see there are a number of other exemptions already existing in the statute, and this simply adds this one to it. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Backlund, you have an amendment.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, I'm representing Vic Backlund from House District 25, which includes Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburgh. I think I have an unusual amendment today, the dash twos, the A-A2. The dash A2 amendment is designed to solve a problem with statewide implications and at the same time allow cities the leeway to fix the problem. Here is the problem as far as background goes. A number of people play golf at their local golf courses, but they own golf carts and they live off the golf course premises. They drive their golf carts over residential streets to the golf course. ORS 810.070 says that for this to be legal, the local road authority, typically the city council, has to pass an ordinance permitting this practice. Right now, anyone driving their golf cart to the golf course is likely doing so illegally, because to my knowledge, cities haven't passed the enabling ordinance, and certainly the 10 cities in the Mid-Willamette Valley have not. And I know that Kara has handed out a statement from the Mid-Willamette Valley Valley Mayors Coalition. There are 10 cities here, and each has signed this statement, and you can see that they're asking in effect what the amendment wants to do, and I'll continue. The city of Kaiser has grappled with this issue for quite some time. A number of people live more than a half a mile from their golf course. Attempts have been made by the Kaiser City Council to write an ordinance, but the council would prefer a legislative fix. The city council has had a full-blown public hearing on the issue, and prior to that, the city council's transportation committee dealt with the issue at least three different times. In addition, the board of the local golf course made a presentation to the city council asking for an ordinance to solve this dilemma. Maybe not problem, but dilemma. A major reason why the council hasn't passed an ordinance is the problem of determining what really constitutes the one-half-mile limit. Is it one-half-mile from the edge of the golf course property? Is it one-half-mile from the clubhouse? Is it one-half-mile from the number one tee? Is it one-half-mile if the golf cart owner takes some creative routes to the golf course? Because the current ORS 810.70 makes it clear that golf cart owners could drive to the golf course if they drive on residential streets 25 miles an hour or less, and if they're within this one-half-mile limit. So I've handed out a signed statement from the mayors of the 10 Mid-Willamette Valley cities, and also a copy of the bill, excuse me, of the law, 810.070. Represent close, it's in one of the handouts. Yeah. So this issue becomes, for me, a great example of cities wanting the power to decide an issue for themselves. This is one example where state law, a one-size-fits-all state law, doesn't necessarily work very well. Cities want the right to decide this issue for themselves. So the Dash A2 amendments do what the mayors of the 10 Mid-Willamette Valley cities have asked me to bring forward, amend out the arbitrary one-half-mile requirement, and allow for real local control. Let the cities write ordinances that reflect the views of their communities. With that, colleagues, I ask for your support of the Dash A2 amendments to Senate Bill 666. Okay. I'm happy to answer any questions, or at least try to.
All right. Questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, when I went into politics as a Democrat, I thought I didn't need to know how to play golf, and so I'm going to ask some really dumb questions.
Representative, excuse me, Chair Doyle and Representative Barnhart, as I used to say to my students, there are no dumb questions.
Yeah, thank you. Do golf carts typically, when they're operated this way, have a slow-moving vehicle sign on them?
Well, Chair Doyle, Representative Barnhart, no. I think the situation is that you have a golf cart. Many golf cart owners will place some number of safety things on them voluntarily. They'll put a flag-like thing. They'll put the triangle on the back. Some of them have lights, headlights, and tail lights. They may turn those on. There's any number of things that they may do, but it's not anything that currently is required.
And yet I would think that's also established by ordinance in some of the local communities as well.
Yeah, Chair Doyle, yeah, that, and I think that's the thought here is the local city councils would make those decisions as to what safety devices, if any, that they would ask in an ordinance.
A follow-up. Under a statute as contemplated in the Dash 2s, Could the city council mandate that golf carts only be operated this way during the daytime or during good weather, or could they make that kind of restriction?
Chair Doyle, Representative Barnhart.
Recognizing you're only going to play golf during the daytime, good weather anyway.
To my knowledge, the answer is yes, because the city councils are asking for the latitude and the freedom to write the ordinance as they see fit. And I'm presuming that depending upon the will of the city council, that what you propose would be a possibility.
Thank you.
Representative Monis Anderson.
Thank you. This, Mr. Chair, this is for Senator Dukes. Regarding this studded tires, will then each, did ODOT explain then that it'll just be up to each transport site or unit to decide if they want to have studded tires on their vehicles or not? It's not going to require every vehicle to have studded tires. Just allow those who want to have them on, have them.
Mr. Chair, excuse me, Representative Moses Anderson, that's correct. If you are a regularly scheduled medical transport, you would have the option.
Options. Yes. Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is for Representative Backlund. I think Representative Barnhart came very close to my concerns. Golfers will play until dusk, until they just can no longer play. And so then they don't leave the course immediately. There's another place that sometimes they visit. And so I'm very concerned, and I'm very willing for the mayor to decide that. But I do think there is a safety concern about carts that are driven long distances, and maybe not even long distances, but where you can't see them at a time of day that's pretty important, and people drive very, very fast. So I think that's a concern. I'm certainly willing to support this because obviously this many mayors want to have it, but I would certainly hope that each city would look at those safety issues very carefully before they start writing their ordinances.
Chair Doyle and Representative Berger, you make an excellent point, of course. To my knowledge, there have been no accidents involving golf carts on residential streets. The normal speed limit on residential street is 25 miles an hour. Top speed for a typical golf course is about 15 miles per hour. They're very conspicuous. So to my knowledge, there have been no accidents. I think probably Your point, though, about safety is something, again, that the city councils of the various cities would address. I'm sure that they would have a public hearing and a work session, and they would consider those kinds of considerations.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you,
Senator. No one else scheduled to testify on this bill, so we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 666. Open up a work session on Senate Bill 666. Mr. Flores?
Mr. Chair, I would move adoption of the Dash 2 amendments.
Representative Flores has moved adoption of the Dash 2 amendments, Senate Bill 666. Discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Yep, I'm looking at the bottom of the first page, line 24. I'm not sure where this goes, but the sentence says, the rules may establish speed limits and other operating standards, but shall not require the golf course conform with vehicle equipment laws under the vehicle code. I'm wondering if that means that that a city ordinance could not require them to have lights that if they run at night or a slow moving vehicle sign or any of those kinds of things, because it can't require them to conform to vehicle equipment laws. Or maybe that's a special rule. I don't know the answer to that, but I just saw it and thought we ought to ask.
Okay. All right, let's ask Doug Tindall to come forward, see if he can answer that.
We'll try. Chair Doyle, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Doug Tindall, State Maintenance Engineer with the Oregon Department of Transportation. Chair Doyle, Representative Barnhart, the vehicle equipment requirements are really extensive, windshields and all of those types of things. I wouldn't have interpreted this to mean that they couldn't ask for any of those things. It was just more that they couldn't ask for the vehicle to be street legal before it was allowed.
Okay. Thank you.
Anything further?
I think that's a good point because it does say it shall not require, but in interpreting it, that doesn't mean that they don't have the option to, right? They could still say require a sign.
Something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Something. Okay.
All right. Any objection to adoption of the Dash 2 amendments? Seeing none, so ordered. So, Flores?
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 666 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores has moved Senate Bill 666 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Okay. Call the roll, please.
Aye.
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 Chair votes aye, and I can't think of a better bill that ought to move to the consent calendar than this one. That's all right. Without objection, so ordered. Senate Bill 666 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And that leaves us with a public hearing opening on Senate Bill 906. Kind of a question. Let's then bring forward a panel of those actually registered to testify. It's John DiLorenzo, Jared Broadfoot, and Sean Miller. Let's see if we can get an introduction to this bill.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John DiLorenzo. I'm an attorney at the firm of Davis Wright Tremaine, and I'm here on behalf of my client, Hoyt Street Properties. Senate Bill 906 is a compendium of various bills, which all originated from the House of Representatives. They were in Representative Close's Committee on Business. They all passed overwhelmingly from her committee. They all passed on the floor of the House of Representatives, garnering at least 55 votes apiece. They were referred to the Senate Business Committee, where they languished. And this was an attempt to move those bills. It was an attempt to do two things. First, to move those bills out of the Senate Business Committee by having the Senate Rules Committee furnish a priority bill. And for that purpose, we're in that regard, we're deeply grateful to Senator Atkinson for supplying his priority bill to do that. Plus, they included consensus amendments, further consensus amendments that had been reached by all of the interests, including all of the agencies that were involved in the bill. For instance, with respect to the section I have an interest in, the Construction Contractors Board included their consensus amendments. Mr. Miller's bill, Mr. Broadfoot's bill also included consensus amendments. And so what you have before you now is a package of bills which has passed from the Senate. They basically have passed here already overwhelmingly. They now include all the consensus amendments, and we are prepared to very briefly chart you through the bill. Sections at first. I'll start with my sections. My sections are sections 68 through 77, and we have for your assistance placed headings in the bill. 68 begins at page
42.
Page 45, and you'll see a heading called Licensed Developers, and that's what I'm here to talk about. I have distributed some formal testimony to you. I'm only going to summarize it. Basically, the current law requires any person who develops property for resale to be licensed as a construction contractor. And there are two problems associated with that. The first problem is that most developers of condominiums must create what are called single asset entities. The banks require that each condominium project be in a separate limited liability company or a separate corporation or a separate partnership. Each separate entity must register as a construction contractor. And although our clients have absolutely no problems with the financial requirements of so registering, each entity must supply a person who will take 16 hours of classes as a prerequisite to being registered as a construction contractor. The entities cannot combine together and supply but one employee to represent all of the entities and take the 16 hours of classes. They must have a separate person for each entity to take the 16 hours. And so what you boil down to is a circumstance in which investors are expected to take 16 hours of classes, even though they are not going to touch the work, and even though licensed general contractors are going to conduct 100% of the work. The other problem is that the law is a trap for the unwary, because if anyone develops property for resale, does not obtain a construction contractor's license, sells the property, and then the ultimate consumer sues that person for construction defects, one of the consequences of not having a license is that you cannot in turn sue anyone else, which means that the developer of the property cannot go against the people who are ultimately responsible for the construction defects. And so we felt by curing those two problems, we would basically make it easier to develop properties and, secondly, eliminate this trap for the unwary and benefit consumers. And so basically what the bill does is it creates a new category of license, a licensed developer. It basically says a licensed developer has to comply with all the financial requirements, all the insurance requirements, all the bonding requirements, just doesn't have to take the 16 hours of classes, provided licensed general contractors do all of the work. In addition, it creates a window to eliminate the trap for the unwary and provides that if you are a licensed developer, you can sue downstream if you are in turn sued. This is the product of consensus amendments with the Construction Contractors Board, and we urge your favorable consideration.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I represent the Associated Builders and Contractors and the Independent Electrical Contractors.
Sean, just have you hold just a moment. Representative Berger,
I do, and I would just like to ask, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Berger, I'm thinking maybe if we can have the introduction of the entire bill first.
Okay,
would it make sense?
All right.
At that point, then we can come back for questions.
I can do that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I represent the Associated Builders and Contractors and the Independent Electrical Contractors. I'll be referring to the sections 54 through 60 dealing with prop payment. It begins on page 31 of the bill. And originally this bill was also deliberated in the originating in the House, in House Bill 3174, sponsored by Representative Knope and carried on the floor by Representative Schaffler. It passed the floor unanimous. It came out unanimous out of Representative Close's business committee. The bill, when we brought this bill this session to deal with a big problem that's occurred in the construction industry revolving around this economy, and that's with the economy there's been a problem on slow payment. And in the construction industry, obviously the flow of money is very important for all of the individuals, but when you're doing the work and workers are doing the work, you expect to get paid for doing that work. And when you float money 60 to 90 days before you get paid, when a normal billing cycle is 30 days, you have labor and employees that are expecting to bring a paycheck home every week, every other week to their families. And it's been a huge problem in the construction industry actually making those payments. It's contributed to many companies going out of business. So the prompt payment provisions within this bill are a simple bill. It simply requires a 30-day billing cycle, which in normal business is a normal billing cycle. But it also gives flexibility to the owners and contractors and subcontractors to do alternative billing cycles. If, for instance, you get into a project and you want to do a 60-day billing cycle, you're able to do that. All you have to do is give notice originally on the construction, on the specifications and plans that you're going to do a alternative billing cycle. So it doesn't lock anybody in on 30 days. It simply says you shall be 30 days unless you want to do something else, and then you just have to tell the contractors. It's then the contractor's responsibility if they want to do an alternative billing cycle or not. So it's their then choice to want to bid on a project or not, knowing that they could get paid beyond 30 days. And so it's again a simple bill, and what we found is that the float has evolved into 60, 90 days and has created a huge problem in the industry. The chain of payment on a construction project begins with the owner, goes to the general contractor. The general contractor then has to pay a bunch of subcontractors, and all of those individuals are playing suppliers at the same time. So you can see if there's one payment from the top down that stops or is delayed by a certain period of time, everybody below that chain is affected because of the how the money flows down the chain. This just lays out a process. It's been a consensus amended bill, in not only in Representative Close's committee but also in the Senate, with the architects, the engineers, the general contractors, subcontractors, and very carefully drafted. And it, we believe, will help the industry get paid when they do the work. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Jared, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jared Broadfoot with PacWest Communications, here today representing the National Electrical Contractors Association, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association, and the United Association of Plumbers and Steam Fitters, Local 290. We'll speak briefly about Sections 61 through 67 and also the sections dealing with the Residential Structures Board and the Mechanical Board. Briefly, involved in Sections 61 through 67, was House Bill 2447, which required licensed tradesmen to wear their identification so it was visible. We felt this would help assist in identification of licensed individuals, help protect consumers who have electricians, plumbers, etc., come out to their house and conduct work so they know that they are licensed. And also there's a very important exemption in this piece that says if it's a danger to the worker's health or for the public's health for wearing that identification, whether it's going to get caught and cause injury, that they don't have to wear it. So that was that piece. The other piece is a false advertising piece. It says that if you are not an electrical contractor or if you do not have an electrical contractor's license, you cannot advertise and tell the public that you are a licensed electrical contractor. Pretty common sense, but something that was not in statute and that had been abused. That basically sums up 61 through 67. There's also a couple pieces in there that allows the Building Codes Division to write rule, gives them the authority to write rule to establish a conflict of interest for individuals who act not only as electrical inspectors but as electrical contractors as well. We've had problems in some specific areas with electrical contractors going to work in the morning and then in the afternoon putting on their inspector hat, inspecting their own work, and then inspecting their competitors. This gives them authority to not only prohibit them from doing it but also work with inspectors in rural areas of the state so they can have a little bit more guidelines. So, and that will be done through the Building Codes Division. The structure, the establishment of the Residential Structures Board and the Mechanical Board, that came from two sessions worth of work, and again has been very slow to come this session, and hopefully we're in the last leg of that. The Mechanical Board, you will see before you today probably some amendments, dash seven amendments, that deal with replacing the public member on the Mechanical Board with a mechanical engineer, and we are opposed to that amendment for a couple of reasons. The first reason is that we feel the public member on this mechanical board is a very important part. It's an open public process, and we feel the public member would do a good job of being able to basically keep the board honest and being able to watch everything that they do, not saying that they would be dishonest, but it's leaves the process open. So, and I do not feel that that this body would like to send the message to the public that that we're not interested in having their input on this board. The second reason is, of course, because this is August, and normally we would not be in the building, but we are, and we hope that we will be out of here soon. We're very concerned if we have any amendments to this bill that sessions and sessions worth of work, consensus work with no opposition, as you'll see today, no one is opposing this bill, we feel would go down the tube because of the time frame, and that it would die between here and the Senate getting back there for concurrence and then to the governor's desk. So we urge that you support this bill, move it to the floor with the due pass recommendation, and oppose the amendments that are before you. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Representative Berger.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, Vice Chair. I took the time to look back at the four bills, and I supported all of them. So my question to you, Mr. DeLorenzo, and also Sean Miller, is anything changed? Because if so, I need to know that. I did not take the time to compare the last bill that I voted for and this bill.
Madam Vice Chair and Representative Verger, I can't speak for the other components of the bills, except to say that for the piece you voted on regarding licensed developers, what has changed is that every single concern of the Construction Contractors Board has been addressed in our bill. And to address those concerns, we changed the name of the license from, I think the first one was developer contractor, and we changed it to licensed developer. We also made some changes specifically at the request of the Construction Contractors Board to make the bill amenable to them.
Yeah. Madam Vice Chair, Representative Berger, on the sections of prop payment, there were three different changes that, after it left Representative Close's committee, that were worked out. They weren't brought up in the committee; they were brought up later on in the process. That was consensus, and I will. The one brought up by the engineers, since the alternative billing cycles is on the plans and specifications, and it's always been our intent that it's the owner's responsibility and liability to make sure that, because they're the ones paying, not the engineer, since they are the ones doing the plans and specs. So I want to make sure on the record we cleared that up in here to make sure it's the owner's responsibility to provide that notice of alternative billing cycle. And so it wasn't, it was our intent, but they wanted it clear so it doesn't change the intent of the bill. The other two changes on page 36, we were originally, this did deal with public contracts as well. And public contracting has its own prompt payment provisions in current law. And we met with local government, and local government felt that they weren't ready to quite make the change to some of the provisions we were doing here, and they thought that was working very well. So we agreed to, on lines 34, page 36, to exclude the public contracts because there's already prompt payment provisions for public contracting. So there's still public contracting prompt pay laws, but they're in their own statute. And the other change is right below that on housing, dealing with low-income housing, lines 35 to 37. The reason why we cannot do low-income housing development is because it involves federal money, and there's a lot of ties and stipulations on some federal money and how that flows in. And so we were exempting public contracts, so even though it was a commercial project, because it involved federal money, we had to make the exception because it would be a little confusing. It's not dealing with private money changes hands, so we had to make that change, and we didn't realize that until we got to the Senate. So those, again, more housekeeping, obviously big issues that needed to be resolved, but something that we were very willing to and made those changes along the way and made it a consensus bill, and that was our intent.
Thank you both.
Further questions? Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Vice Chair. I think this is for John DiLorenzo. When we're talking about licensed developers, we know, and I think it's more for my personal information, we have the land developers or housing development. We have malls. But we also have public works or public contracts. And is there a conflict with even public entities that maybe do their own contracting? Do you know anything about that? Would that have anything? And I'll cite an example. There are a couple of ESDs that do some public contract work, so to speak.
Chapter 279. Yeah. Madam Chair and Representative Moss Anderson, I believe the question really relates to whether or not public entities would be required to obtain construction contractors licenses if they develop property for resale. First of all, most
resale.
They don't do that. They develop property for themselves. Plus, I don't think they're probably included as one of the types of persons who would be required to obtain a construction contractor's license anyway. This bill relates to persons who develop property specifically for resale, who then rely 100% on other licensed general contractors. And the question is, what type of license should they obtain, and what are the results of obtaining that license?
You've clarified it. Thanks.
No further questions. Thank you, panel.
Thank you very much.
Marshall Koba.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Marshall Koba, representing the American Council of Engineering Companies of Oregon, in support of not what is printed on your letterhead. I'm sure the Dash 6 was a great amendment, but I am here in support of the Dash 7 amendments of Senate Bill 906. I'd like to start out by making a couple just general comments, and the first is timing on this. I know there's been some concerns about no amendments, and we need to get moving. I don't think any of us believe that we are so close to sine die that we're not going to be able to move an amendment back across to the Senate. I believe this bill will get strong support out of the House. It passed with, I believe it was called overwhelming support. My amendment would not do anything to impact that overwhelming support. As a matter of fact, I would look forward to the opportunity to help push through the Senate and maybe get all the votes next time. Secondly, in the Senate hearing, Senator Atkinson, who is the sponsor of the bill, did make a comment on the record that he would like to see the mechanical engineer added to the mechanical board. With that said, we strongly support the addition of a mechanical engineer to the newly created mechanical board to help protect the public health and safety. Mechanical engineers are responsible through their education and experience to apply uniform building codes on all projects from hospitals, schools, and others where air cooling and heating and air circulation is important. It is the mechanical engineer who determines the proper air circulation system, sizing for fans, ductwork, and filtration to ensure the proper usage of energy and maintain sensitivity to environmental concerns. The technology in this area is very high-tech and is advancing regularly. It is the mechanical engineer who is responsible for staying current on the latest technology and designing systems that maximize system needs while understanding project budgets. Hospitals are a great example of mechanical engineering for improving healthcare services for patients and staff. Proper filtration, along with proper air cooling, air heating, and circulation, is vital to keeping patients and healthcare providers safe. It is a mechanical engineer who designs the system that is then installed by the installers who are well represented on the board. This is an important amendment to ensure public health and safety. The addition of a mechanical engineer will ensure an independent, knowledgeable, and experienced person will serve on the board. We urge your support of the -7 amendments. I'd like to point out in the bill, if you go to page 2, you'll see the design professional, the engineer, or architect is on the other board. On page 2, section 2, the residential structures board, -G has one structural engineer on the residential structures board. If you go back to page 11, the building code structures board has an engineer on it. So I think that it's been shown that the importance of having a design professional on these boards is very important to ensure public health and safety. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Monis Anderson.
Thank you. Is there a mechanical engineer right now in here? I mean, like, C, one municipal mechanical inspector possessing the highest level of mechanical inspector certification. Is it possible that they have a mechanical engineering background? And also, in I, there's one public member who does not receive compensation. Is it possible that there is a mechanical engineer in that could be there also? I don't know if you're aware of that.
Chair Flores, Representative Monis Anderson. As far as the municipal inspector, I'm not sure what sort of an education that person may or may not have. It's very possible they may have had some mechanical engineering. As far as the public member, as you can read on there, it says who does not receive any compensation. I guess maybe that could be a retired mechanical engineer if that were the case, but nobody, of course, who would be working in the field on a daily basis, making decisions, staying abreast of the latest technology, and again, continuing to work towards maintaining the public health and safety.
Is there anyone that knows the people that are consisting, that are on the board now, that could give any testimony on whether there's a mechanical engineer present?
The original board.
I meant with background. I was just looking at, like I said, a municipal mechanical inspector, and then a building official. Of course, that would make...
Okay.
No, Chair Flores, Representative Monis Anderson, a licensed PE, an engineer, a mechanical engineer is what we are seeking in this position on the mechanical board.
Is Mark Long, Building Codes, here able to answer that?
He's not.
There's someone else.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mark Long, I am the Administrator of Building Codes Division. If you could remind me what the question before you is so that I can help you.
Yes, thank you. I am just wondering what the type of training that maybe some of these other representatives on the board might consist of, and I was just... and if it was comparable training maybe to a mechanical engineer. And I was just looking at the one municipal mechanical inspector, which possesses the highest level mechanical inspector certification. Is that usually a mechanical engineer or not, or, you know, with that kind of a background? As well as on the board, there was a public member, too.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative Monis Anderson. I don't specifically know if there's a mechanical inspector out there that has the engineering background. I suspect there is in some of the larger jurisdictions. That's where you see them. We don't have one on staff in our area. It's not a requirement to get the certification, so it would be it's an add that that's out there. Now, as far as some of the other positions, I would imagine that some of these folks might have it, but again, I can't tell you with certainty, and we're not uncomfortable. Marshall has shared his concern with us, and we're not uncomfortable working with him to, you know, whether it's the public member spot, I'm pretty sure we can work through that, or one of the other ones, you know, putting preference for a mechanical engineer or some or a background of that nature. But I'm happy to go whichever way the committee wants to go on this issue.
Thank you. Thank you.
Chair Flores, my name is Ron Murray. I represent the United Association of Plumbers and Steamfitters Local 290. And today I'm also going to represent the American Society of Sanitary Engineers, who also support this bill. I sit on the Tri-County Industry Advisory Board, and on that board we truly have a subcommittee, a mechanical subcommittee, where people from the industry, installers, contractors, so forth and so on, bring questions to the committee to ensure code consistency and conformity throughout the entire Tri-County area. And the contractors themselves, the HVAC contractors, the individual that they select does happen to be a mechanical engineer. So almost any of the positions that are available on this mechanical board could be filled by a mechanical engineer, and the HVAC contractors can choose to send an engineer. The air conditioning contractors can choose to send an engineer. Of course, the public member or the building officials could also. We were one of the originators of this bill, and have been working, as you've heard many times here, over two sessions to get it this far. So we're certainly willing to work with any industry to make sure that they're well represented, and I'm certainly not opposing having a mechanical engineer on this board in any way, shape, or form, but we would like to see it move in its unamended form. If I could answer any questions.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. This, I think, is for Mr. Koba. The amendment that we have takes out the public member and substitutes this mechanical engineer. Is there a reason for excluding a public member from this board?
Chair Flores, Representative Barnhart, there is no reason. We have had discussions for the last, talking to the building codes about adding members. I mean, they like the number. What is it? Nine members on the board. I appreciate and understand and acknowledge the sensitivity of the makeup of the board. There's a lot of good things in this bill. There's no question about it, and we're not here to cause trouble for it, except for we have some concerns about public health and safety and somebody being on there that's job on a daily basis is staying on the cutting edge of what's going on here. So when you look at the sensitivity, in a kind of a sad commentary, there's no one here representing the public except maybe the legislature. So we thought that that would be the position to put the mechanical engineer.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Bridges.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I think that there are just a couple of things that bother me. One is that I would not want to remove a public member. I think that that always is an indication to the public that they're welcome. And to have a representative on the committee, I think, is important. The other thing, I think that this looks to me like a bill that has had a great deal of work and a lot of time spent on it. There have been four bills that have been put into one. And so I would think that probably this request, Marshall, has had some time to have come and been into the process of getting your member on in before now. And I'm eager to move the bill on. I believe that if there's some leeway in one of these positions, that at some point when that term of office is up, they can bring on a mechanical engineer. I think that would be just great. I don't think anybody opposes having that on the committee, but I think that I would be eager to move the bill today.
Further comments, Representative Barnhart?
Well, thank you. Just to make a note, if I read the bill correctly, this is a new board.
That's correct.
So there aren't any current members, so presumably this issue could be dealt with right up front at the appointment time.
Chair Flores, if I could respond to Representative Verger, if you look at Section 17, The Building Code Structures Board on page 11 at the bottom, they've added I, and that happened on the Senate side. So by passing out this bill today, you will be removing two public members off of that board, and they will be replaced by a representative selected from individuals recommended by the Oregon Disabilities Commission. So to the extent the Oregon Disabilities Commission is the public, I think maybe it's the public, but it is removing language that says two public members already.
Right. May I respond? I think what they did was they wanted the public member to be a person that represented disabilities. Is that correct?
Anything further?
Madam Chair?
Yeah.
Thank you. So back to page 2 on the public member. There's nothing in the bill that would preclude that person being a mechanical engineer. Is that correct? Would that be
that's correct.
Yeah. And
sure.
Preference could be given for perhaps to a mechanical engineer. It wouldn't have to be mandated, but preference could be given, or consideration could certainly be a major factor, let's say.
Chair Flores, Representative Backlund, I think that one public member who does not receive compensation, I believe that would be the problem. So it would be a retired, an unemployed mechanical engineer, or a retired mechanical engineer. And that's, I think, the point I'm trying to make here is that it's a changing area. It's a dynamic world of mechanical engineering, and things are changing. And we need somebody who is current, somebody who's working in this area on a daily basis to, again, ensure the public health and safety. So I had come here, I think, only anticipating opposition based on the time frame. And I think the time frame is there's plenty of time. We're going to be here for another week or two, I think, if I read the paper and hear the rumors correctly. There's plenty of time to draft up a three-word amendment and run it back over to the Senate, where it passed with overwhelming support. At the same time, ensuring that the mechanical board gets started, as Representative Barnhart has pointed out, it's a new board. It gets started out in the right manner.
Seeing no further comment, I would thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Like to be sure the record notes that we do have a letter dated August 5 from the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association. And we'll close the public hearing. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 906. The chair has indicated an interest in moving the consensus bill without amendment, and then I would entertain a motion. That's the end of that one.
Excuse me, Madam Chair.
Comment. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. I you made a comment that I was going to ask you a question about. I don't know the answer. I don't need to ask the comment.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, you would like an amendment that we move the Senate Bill 906. Yes, a motion, yeah. Thank you very much. I move Senate Bill 906 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Any comments?
Yes.
Representative Monty Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. I think that we are not considering the -7 or A7 amendments, but I think that those who are involved in this new mechanical board probably have taken this interest and would hopefully take that into consideration in the appointment of the board. And I would think that the makeup of the board, design and safety is extremely important, and I would hope that would be reflected on the people who serve on it.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that Mr. Cobra's made a good case for inclusion of an engineer, a mechanical engineer, on that board, and under different circumstances, I would support that as an amendment. On the other hand, I also think it's very important to have a public member on that board, and I will say that I'm a bit concerned about the removal of the unaffiliated public members from the Building Code Structural Board, and the replacement of the two public members with a representative of a particular public. I don't have any objection to I, but I think the old M, line 40 on page 11, should have been changed to 1 and kept instead of removing both unaffiliated public members. I haven't looked through to see if we've done the same thing in other areas. Doesn't look like we have. Generally speaking, it seems to me that these kinds of boards benefit from having an unaffiliated public member who, in the process of the board's work, has to be educated about what it is that the board's doing, and so that the professionals will then, in effect, have to justify what they're working on, what they're doing, to an intelligent and ultimately well-informed member of the public. That's a policy that the legislature's followed in setting up a lot of boards. I think it's a good policy. I'm sorry to see that we're moving away from that in the one case, even though we're going to protect it in the other. Having said that, I'm going to support the bill for all the reasons that have already been indicated.
Thank you. Any further comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill takes me back to that old adage. I feel very strongly on both sides of the issue. And I'm afraid in this case that doesn't work too well. I can see the merits, certainly, though, for the inclusion of a mechanical engineer. I certainly like the idea of a public representative as well. And I guess I am impressed in that four bills that have passed have been included into this, and it has been over a long period of time that this has taken place. So I will support the bill and without the amendment, maybe regrettably, but I guess that's where I come down at this point.
Well, that's what we like is affirmation.
Yes.
Okay. Anything further? Natalie, will you call the roll?
President Backlund.
Aye.
President Barnhart.
Aye.
President Close.
Aye.
President Willis Anderson.
Aye.
President Berger.
Aye.
Willis Anderson.
Excused.
And Chair Ford.
Aye. And Representative Close, will you be willing to carry this bill?
Yes.
Thank you. Representative Close will carry the bill. It's passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Work session is closed. The Rules Committee is adjourned.
Wow, you are efficient.
We're meeting tomorrow.